You're listening to The Pivot, brought to you by Globally News, where we discuss the leaders, states, networks, ideologies, and technologies that are reshaping the world order. Visit our website at globally.news. That's globe.news.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Pivot. My name is Arif Rafiq, and I'm your host. Since 2021, the tiny South American country of Guyana has been home to the world's fastest-growing economy. And that growth has been fueled by oil. Guyana has lots of it. In fact, Guyana has the largest oil reserves in the world on a per capita basis. And by 2035, Guyana could be the world's fourth largest producer of oil. Guyana's newfound fortune brings with it both promise and peril. Guyana has long been one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere. And so there's hope that the oil revenues can transform the country's economy and improve the lives of its people. But alongside the promise of prosperity, there's also the peril that this opportunity can be squandered, as it has been in so many other resource-rich countries. Guyana also faces a host of other challenges to its oil ambitions, including climate change, long-standing racial divisions, and renewed threats from neighboring Venezuela. And so to address the question of whether this tiny country of 900,000 people can change its destiny, we're joined by Dr. Jay Mandel, a professor emeritus of economics at Colgate University and a member of the University of Guyana Green Institute Advisory Board. Dr. Mandel has studied Guyana for more than half a century, and we're very lucky to have him on. Dr. Mandel, thank you for joining us.
Arif, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to have an opportunity to have a discussion about Guyana.
So Guyana strikes oil in 2015. It starts pumping oil by 2020. I'd like you to help our listeners understand how big a deal this is for Guyana, given the deep poverty in the country. What was the state of the economy before oil started being produced?
Yeah, this is an enormous big deal. Probably unprecedented in recent history throughout the world, where a country which was one of the poorest, comparable to Haiti in the Western Hemisphere, now is the beneficiary of an enormous inflow of wealth, which is raising the per capita GDP of the country soon to be the level at close to or not equal to the United States of America, which, of course, shows the misleading nature of using GDP to evidence a standard of living because in the country, because though the oil has been pumping and the revenues coming to the government have been skyrocketing, the question remains how much of that is distributed to the population in the form of rising standards of living. And it's the nature of the experience with regard to petroleum that means that unless there is purposeful work to do that kind of distribution, it doesn't occur because the revenue, largely revenue comes into the government. The industry does not create very many employment opportunities. And so the effect of the revenue is still to be determined by what government policy is. And to date, and it's early days, so it's a little bit unfair to do this, but to date, there has been some, but not much, redistribution from the government back to the population of the country.
Right. And so, you know, these phenomenal growth figures that we've been hearing in the press, I think 60%, a 60% GDP growth rate last year or in 2022, and then 30% after that, that only tells a small piece of the story. And the real question is the distribution of those windfalls. And it's very early in the game, but at this point, there's no, you know, significant demonstrable impact on the average Guyanese person. And so I think in terms of, you know, the future question, that's ultimately what has to be the focus. And that's going to be the focus of our discussion.
Yeah.
But before we get to the question of these windfalls, along with poverty, Guyana has had a longstanding division on the basis of race. There are two major ethnic groups, the Afro-Caribbeans and the Indo-Caribbeans. And just to summarize for our listeners, Afro-Caribbeans make up about 30% of the population. They trace their ancestry back to enslaved Africans who were brought to the Caribbean during the transatlantic slave trade from the 16th to the 19th centuries, Indo-Caribbeans make up a slightly larger percentage of the population, about 40%. They descend from indentured laborers who were brought by the British primarily between the mid-19th and early 20th century. And then there are indigenous peoples and communities that are mixed. But these racial divides have had a really big political impact on the country. They've largely shaped voting behavior. And for most of the country's independent history, Guyana gained independence from Britain in 1966. It's seen the alternation of power between parties that largely represent one of the two major racial groups. Now, Dr. Mendel, my question to you is, how important is race still today in Guyana?
I want to go back because there is a history to this. When the first independence movement in Guyana and the effort to shed the country from British colonialism was created, this movement was created in the late 1940s and into the early 1950s, the leading group, the leading political party, called the People's Progressive Party, was initially biracial, led by Chetty Jagan on one hand, Indo-Guyanese, and Forbes Burnham on the other hand, an Afro-Guyanese. And the tragedy of the country was that that alliance broke apart. And so there is, it was not as if there have not been significant efforts and some history to a multiracial Guyana. But from 1955, when the party split, and then the independence movement was interfered with by outside agents, the colonial power and the United States, fearing Jagan's flirtation with communism. So there has been some manipulation that has interfered with what could otherwise perhaps have been a different history altogether. But today, that racial division especially shows up politically, not so much in the social life of the country. Walk down the streets of Georgetown and you don't see any segregation of the kind that used to exist in this southern United States. But come election day, the dominant parties still are racially based. The PPP, the version of the PPP that exists now, is an Indo-Guyanese party. The version of the now opposition party is largely based upon the Afro-Guyanese electorate. And this has been harmful. The fact that there is such a racial and ethnic division has impeded the progress of the country to consolidate and, in this case, take advantage of what limited expertise is in the country. Half of the population, virtually half of the population, is unavailable to the government to formulate appropriate policy.
Right, and it seems like the political system is stuck in the sort of past framework that to some extent was shaped by the divide and rule policies of outside powers. Yeah. Now, there have been attempts by a third party, the Alliance for Change, to break from this racial politics that has dominated the country since roughly, you know, the post-independence period into today. How successful has it been?
There have been several efforts at what are called third-party politics in the country, and the AFC was part of those efforts. Joined the opposition party in the election that occurred in 2015, but there was little electoral support, and so in the alliance that was created, the AFC had only a small and marginal voice in actual policy formation. And it is unlikely that they will be part of an alliance again when the next election comes in 2025. And so, though there have been efforts at it, and the most important, in my view, effort in that regard was in the 1970s, when the Working People's Alliance was quite effective in challenging the autocracy of the Burnham government of that period. A movement that was led by Walter Rodney, an eminent, you know, historian and well-known third world activist, So there have been efforts in that regard, but still the stereotype view of the electoral process of being dominated by ethnicity and race among the two dominant parties still holds.
So this political bifurcation, at least for the foreseeable future, is here to stay. And, you know, naturally, when you have tens of billions of dollars flowing into a country, and the question of what to do with it is a political question. And it's the question, the essential question of politics, of who gets what, when, and how. And in a racially stratified poor country, this kind of newfound wealth really has a potential to compound these divides, if not handled correctly. And we'll get into the question of what to do with the wealth in a bit. But first, I want to talk about the deal itself. So an ExxonMobil-led consortium that consists of Hess and the state-owned China National Offshore Oil Corporation, or CNOOC, discovered offshore oil in Guyana in 2015. They signed a deal with the Guyanese government in 2016. And that process of oil discovery to contract signing and actual production proceeds very rapidly. And there's been some significant criticism that the terms of the deal are simply too much in favor of this ExxonMobil-led consortium. So just to go over a few aspects of the deal, you know, the big picture is that it's literally a sweet deal for Exxon. Guyana produces light, sweet crude oil. It's regarded as the best of its kind. It's high energy, more efficient and cleaner. And Guyanese oil has a pretty low break-even price of around $28. In terms of revenue sharing, traditionally, we see 75% going to governments and 25% by the oil producer. But in this case, Exxon and Guyana are splitting it 50-50, or the Exxon-led coalition and Guyana are splitting it 50-50. The consortium also has a very large leasing area, roughly 9 times greater than what Exxon averages elsewhere. And then there's also the question of liability in the event of an accident. And so this is offshore oil, and so there's a potential for a spill into the maritime space off of Guyana's coast, and that could impact not just Guyana, but also its neighbors. And if there is some sort of devastation, Guyana could be fiscally responsible in terms of compensating its neighbors, and that compensation may, those financial penalties may exceed the windfalls from this newfound wealth. So back to you, Dr. Mandel. Generally speaking, what is the state of state capacity in Guyana? I'm talking about regulatory institutions, legal brain power, economic planning bodies. You know, all of this points towards how it can manage this relationship with oil producers. Does Guyana have that capacity right now?
This is the reason that it's important to understand history and the importance of history in assessing contemporary development. I mean, up until almost literally the day before yesterday, this was a poor country in which its income was largely resulting from the cultivation of rice, the mining of gold, to some extent bauxite. Sugar had historically been the preeminent source of revenue in the country. It had declined. And so the society was organized and its institutions were functional in a low-level, low-income trap, largely agricultural and largely commodities, which did not involve very much processing. So there was little capacity, virtually no capacity, to handle this enormous influx of wealth and revenue that was coming from petroleum. All the more, this situation was exacerbated by the fact that the country had experienced an enormous outflow of a migration, one of the highest emigration rates of highly skilled, highly educated people in the world. And so, it's inconceivable that the society could suddenly adjust its institutions, its policies, its functions to this enormous amount of wealth. That takes time. That institutions have a history. People have a history. And still to this day, the country is struggling to adapt what was primarily an agricultural low-income country to a country that is now the beneficiary, that was in quotation marks, to a major inflow of revenue. So people are aware of the need to adapt and change the society to these new circumstances, but that takes a lot of time.
That takes a lot of time, and there's a limited window to exploit this opportunity because we're essentially in a transition towards a post-fossil fuel economic order. And so if they want to take it slow, the value of these commodities could very well dwindle because of the declining use and oversupply. So
yes, but there's a trade-off there. I mean, the current government is committed to taking as much petroleum out of the ground, out of the sea, as quickly as possible. And you can understand the logic of it. But the problem is then the issue that becomes, can the wealth be efficiently used? And to what purpose should the wealth be efficiently used? And that takes time and consideration. And so the real worry is if as they are doing now, they are trying to maximize the outflow, there's a cost to doing that that is not being considered and may result at the end of the petroleum boom, less diversification, less alternative than could otherwise have been achieved if they had gone more slowly and made their institutional adaptations more of a priority than is currently the case.
Right. And we'll go deeper into that in a bit. But, in terms of addressing the question of the skills deficit, there's also, one of the many conundrums that Guyana faces. You know, there's an obvious need to train its labor force for skilled jobs in the petroleum sector. But at the same time, its population is very small. And so, there's a potential that it's also losing the opportunities to develop a workforce for a post-oil economy. And so is there a significant potential that, let's say a few decades from now, we could have stranded assets, both in terms of the infrastructure that's developed, but also the human capital?
We have to be careful because the question of timing is very uncertain. There's quite a bit of discussion about when Guyana's petroleum will lose its market. That's very unlikely that it's going to run out of petroleum, but the question of the global transition away from fossil fuels is an issue. And it's very uncertain, but people are talking about 2050, something like that. So there is that risk, but there is ample time, I think, between now and whenever that time occurs to move in the direction of a diversified Guyanese economy. And that's the reason I myself am not particularly concerned with whether the deal is good, bad, or indifferent. I am much more concerned with how the revenue is being used and used in two potential directions. One, to do poverty alleviation. People in the country still are very poor, very low income. And there is a question of how much of the current generated revenue that goes to the government should be redistributed just immediately to alleviate poverty. And then the second issue is, are the resources that are being generated by petroleum being used in a cautious, careful plan to achieve the diversity, the diversified economy that really is required once the petroleum boom ends? And so those are the two issues that are looming in the country. And I consider those to be the two issues of much greater importance than, is the deal good, bad, or indifferent?
Right. You've zeroed in on the key question on what to do with the money. Now, the scale of this deal, and there could be other deals that emerge as a result of contracts that are awarded to other producers. But the scale of this deal is tremendous on a per capita basis. And so in 2015, when oil was discovered, Guyana's annual budget was roughly $1.1 billion. Its GDP was $3.8 billion. It now earns roughly $1 to $2 billion in annual revenue from the oil production. And that's expected to rise over the next decade and beyond as production increases, new projects come online and the Guyanese government gets a greater share of revenue. How exactly has the Guyanese government been spending this revenue so far?
Well, in the country, there is an enormous change going on in its physical appearance. Highways are being constructed, houses are being constructed, hotels are going up all over the place. And so there is evidence of transformation. And the concern is not that there is no change. There is a lot of change going on. But the question of whether there is careful planning, careful management, careful implementation of all of these activities, that question is at the moment unresolved. The question that is at issue here is, when a country becomes the beneficiary of the inflows that the Guyana currently is, that industry becomes a magnet for other sectors of the economy to be attracted to it. Business people, if there is a Guyanese entrepreneurial class of limited skill and limited financial resources. And so those business people looking to the future see opportunities to service the petroleum industry. And the market dictates that's what they should do. So when that happens, however, the private sector becomes attached to and involved with petroleum. For those business people to be attracted to and invest in alternative industries would be in effect to go against the market. And the only way that would occur is if there is public policy incentives of a considerable amount that would induce business people to make the investments in the alternative sectors of the economy that they otherwise would not be. That takes a very sophisticated public sector that would investigate on its own what are the industries that could function in Guyana, what would be required to induce the private sector to make those investments. If that's not done, the country's economy will remain lopsided in the direction of petroleum. This is called the resource curse. And what is not going on sufficiently at this time is the construction of that public sector institution that can guide the economy in a way that the market alone will not do.
And, you know, right now we see a lot of investment or spending on road development and things like that are essential in many ways. But there is the risk that the oil revenue inflows may simply amount to, at least in the short term, to wealth transfer to state-preferred contractors like companies that build roads and other types of public works. Do we see any indication of greater public spending on education, healthcare, and skills development?
Well, you know, at the moment, there is a major teacher strike going on in the country. And it's interesting to hear the debate that the government has taken a very strong line in opposing the teachers' union and its demands, arguing that instead of giving the money, increased money to the teachers, they are building schools and facilities, and those facilities will enhance the lives of the teachers. Now, there is an argument there, and the argument is that there should be a priority that is assigned to, for example, buildings. They had a disastrous fire in which a good number of children were killed in the fire, so there was a reason to do that. But this is an issue that should be subjected to discussion and debate. How much of the money should go to infrastructure? How much of the money should go to the teachers who, after all, are low paid? And that kind of discussion having to do with how should the resources that are being generated by the petroleum sector, that discussion is not sufficiently engaged in Guyana, partially because of the racial divide, that the way the country is configured politically, the party that is in power and the ethnic group that is thereby empowered do not share with the opposition party and the different ethnic group. They don't share enough trust with each other to have this kind of meaningful discussion. So this teacher strike, which is quite serious, teachers have been out for considerable time now, kind of illustrates the conundrum that the country faces. They have limited human personnel, and they can take advantage of only some of it, the group of the personnel that's associated with the political party that is in power. And so the hashing out of how actually to use this resource in the most efficient way, which takes deliberation and discussion, doesn't sufficiently happen.
Right. And if they, you know, focused on building a consensus in terms of how to use this this money, that would not only add to stability to policymaking and help ensure that, you know, the public interest is better met, but it also help ensure that some of these, you know, decisions are not overturned by the next government.
Good point. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so in terms of, you know, these different potential uses for the funds, there are, you know, a host of other energy producing countries that have adopted different models, some quite close to Guyana and others quite distant. And so let's start with some of Guyana's neighbors. Venezuela, Trinidad, and even Suriname are oil producers. Are there any lessons to be learned from their experiences?
I know a great deal more about Trinidad and Tobago than I do about Venezuela. Everybody knows that Venezuela has been a disaster in terms of avoiding the resource curse. Trinidad is an interesting case where they had a not nearly as much as Guyana, but they had a tremendous boom, and there was really quite an extensive discussion about how to proceed with it, and the two sides in the discussion were something similar to what I think will occur in Guyana now. On one hand, there was the side that says domestic content means that we can hire, a lot of firms can engage in contracts with the petroleum sector, and the private sector, the firms that provide these services to the Trinidad and Tobago petroleum sector, will, by virtue of their providing those services, become skilled and be able to use the skills that they learn in servicing the petroleum sector. That will help Trinidad and Tobago to become a modern economy. The other side said, no, they get trapped. You know, the kind of argument that I was just making, they get trapped in providing continued services to the petroleum sector. And then therefore, when, as has occurred in Trinidad and Tobago, petroleum recedes in importance and they're left with some sector left, natural gas is important, the lopsided nature of the economy because of the resource, the attraction is the attraction of the resources of petroleum, the attraction then means that when petroleum recedes, they're back to a single kind of economy in which they're not diversified, but much poorer. So the lesson from Trinidad and Tobago, I think, is one that is important that Guyana look at, because it, the same experience in Trinidad, the current in Trinidad, are going to eventually occur in Guyana. And between now and then, it's important to build a non-petroleum sector of the economy that can survive after petroleum is gone.
Right. And, you know, other oil-rich regions and countries have taken distinct approaches in terms of managing oil revenue and even directing some of it towards their populations in a direct way through dividend payments. So, for example, Alaska has the Alaska Permanent Fund. And, you know, last year, roughly $1,300 were paid to each of its residents in the form of an annual dividend. Other countries, such as Norway, have established sovereign wealth funds that are pretty exemplary in terms of their transparency and prudent managing of these funds. Guyana has established what's described as a sovereign wealth fund, the natural resource fund. What do we know about it?
Well, we know it's big, and we also know that government has been tempted to tap into that to an extent that was not anticipated ahead of time. That's a temptation that exists because this whole process of what to do with the wealth has not been subjected to careful deliberation and discussion. The issue that you raised, the issue of providing a grant to the population such as exists still to this day in Alaska, has been discussed in Guyana. It's under the heading of what's called the Buxton Proposal. This was initiated by a now retired economics professor at the University of Guyana, Clive Thomas. Neither party has taken this as a proposal that it wants to carry into power. It's obviously the single most rapid way of reducing poverty in the country. Nothing would beat it, especially as I mentioned before, the industry is not labor intensive. The revenue that comes into the country from petroleum goes to only a few individuals. And so allocating this amount of some substantial amount of that inflow to the population would do wonders for the reduction in poverty. There are obvious arguments made that perhaps it will provide a disincentive for the people to want to engage labor force. I doubt it. I doubt that's not been the problem in Alaska, and I doubt that the problem in Guyana. Another related part of that, Guyana has a reputation for being subject to considerable amount of corruption. Well, the amount of corruption that would be feasible would be considerably reduced if a large fraction of the money that comes into the government went directly to the population rather than in the hands of, you know, public officials who are under continuous temptation to take their more than their fair cut out of that money. So discussion that we've had, that there has not been sufficient care and deliberation, and maybe even a slowing of the process of allocating to infrastructure and buildings and highways, and the rush to spend may come at a cost that will be experienced in the future when the opportunities to use the wealth for diversification will have not been adequately employed.
Right, right. And at least a partial direct transfer to all adult citizens would at least ensure that everyone at least has a sense that they're getting a piece of the pie.
And another argument in that with regard to that, the one that I've adopted and discussed with people in Guyana, but with to no avail, I must say, is that the party that accepts a universal grant will no doubt win over some adherents from the ethnic group that they are weak with. It would be a way of breaking down the ethnic division of the political process. And I'm afraid that that has been rejected because the leadership of the two divisions in the political process have an vested interest in the division. Because it seems to me clear that if the one party provided resources to the opposition population, that would be a mechanism for breaking down the ethnic division, and they have not taken advantage of it.
Right. Yeah. And if you look at both how the elections turn out in terms of the split between the two largest parties, it overlaps with, it largely aligns with the ethnic division. So this kind of 40-30 split, yeah, we see, you know, roughly like a 50-40 split to some extent in terms of the general elections. And so the politics is very much frozen.
Yeah.
And it disincentivizes political actors who are concerned with electoral timelines to really try adopt measures that break the status quo.
That's right.
Now, you know, another complication for Guyana is this question of climate change. And here, Guyana finds itself in a bit of a paradoxical situation. It faces the threat, and an immediate threat, of rising sea levels. And so the more oil the world uses, at least theoretically speaking, the more acute Guyana's climate crisis becomes, or the climate threat becomes. But at the same time, some would say it would be crazy for Guyana not to avail itself of this immediate opportunity in terms of the inflows of the billions of dollars from oil revenues. Before we get to the specifics of Guyana's climate challenge, you know, one possibility is that developed countries simply pay Guyana not to extract its oil. Do you find that proposal to be practical?
Well, no. And there has been quite a bit of discussion at the COP, the end of the United Nations meetings with regard to climate change, quite a bit of discussion with regard to precisely that. And it pertains in Guyana with respect to the tropical rainforest, which is a wonderful carbon sink and is a resource in the struggle with regard to climate change that has to be preserved. Now, Guyana has recently obtained some funding to compensate it for preserving the forest, but it is limited, and it has been under great duress to get this thing done. Mostly, this discussion has been of frustrating to countries of the South, who, after all, have not been the source of climate change, because what they are asking for is resources to allow them to adapt to climate change. And though at the recent COP28 meeting, there was a very serious discussion of that provided by the countries of the South, but the donors have been very reluctant to provide the level of resources that would require to do that. This is a question. This is really an ethical question, because the victimization comes from a handful of the developed countries. The countries that are the victims are asking for compensation, and it has been very slow and very inadequately provided to them. I doubt that that's going to change very much. So with respect to the question that you raised, is it feasible? Is it realistic? I think it's unlikely. Guyana is itself going to be both this source of the petroleum and therefore contribute to climate change. I do not accept that Guyana should eschew the benefits of petroleum. That would be something that would be so outrageously irresponsible with respect to the poverty in the country that I can't accept that. On the other hand, Guyana at the same time is going to be the victim of climate change. 90% of the population of Guyana lives on the coastal plain that is both below sea level and is threatened from inundation from the interior. Guyana is going to be confronted with the need to displace. They're going to be confronting the problem of displacement of the population from the coastal plain to other places in the country. And that in turn then threatens the question of where they're going to go. Is the tropical rainforest going to be decimated in order to provide locations for these people to live? So Guyana is caught in the in between, both as a petroleum producer and in that sense, a contributor to climate change, but on the other hand, it provides a great amount of wealth to the country. And then on the other hand, as sea rise occurs, the coastal plain is going to be inundated and country will be the victim of the process. Talk about a paradox. There is a definite paradox.
Right, right. And I share your realism. You know, when we look at developed countries, they've talked the talk on climate and compensating developing countries for pollution that they've caused and along their path toward becoming developed countries. But they really haven't walked the walk. And so whenever we have these COP meetings, recently they've been held in oil-producing states, first the UAE, now Azerbaijan this year. And, you know, developing countries really have to kind of squeeze as much as they can out of developed states. And so there's a lot of this performative talk about climate and it often amounts to kind of greenwashing, you know, what are very damaging economic policies of these countries over the past decades and even till today. And it should be noted that Ghana has done a pretty good job in terms of preserving its forests. And it's, you know, overperformed in many ways compared to many other countries. And so what it's facing on its coastline is quite tragic, given that, taking all that into account. Now, getting to what's happening on its coastline, you'd already addressed it to some degree, but we have around 90% of its population lives along the coast. And, you know, there's talk of its capital, Georgetown, being inundated with water by 2030, could be submerged by 2030. There are some of these very dire predictions. And so this is not simply just, you know, a PowerPoint presentation by climate activists, you know, filled with dark scenarios. The clock is literally ticking. And there are plans to shift much of the populace towards, I guess, the central part of the country. There's plans for developing this smart city, Silica City. Could you talk to us about what the Guyanese government is trying to do in terms of shifting its population from this coastal area to the center?
There are three forms of demographic change that the country is going to have to confront soon. One is the one that we just finished talking about. The fact that a substantial number of the Guyanese population are going to have to move from the coastal plain to someplace else. That's one internal migratory flow. A second migratory flow is into the country. That is in the form of the skilled workers that the industry, the petroleum industry, will require and which are not available domestically. And then third, there's another flow, a flow of low-income, not very technically skilled people who will be attracted to the country by virtue of the wealth and the spillover that it comes from the wealth from petroleum. So at the moment, the country is looking in the next 5-10 years at a substantial dislocation of its population from the coastal on one hand, and an inflow of people servicing the industry and attracted to the industry. This will require a major change in the spatial distribution and location of the population. Up on the road from the coast to Linden, what's called the Sosdike-Linden Highway, the government is constructing a new city plan, which they've called Silica City. Very little of the detail of the city has been made public. It's being designed, interestingly enough, not by Guyanese, but by architects and others, the technical people at the University of Miami. So the little that is been made available seems to suggest that it is being designed for the technical people who will be servicing the industry and coming in one of the three inflows of the population. It's not designed for a very large numbers of people. It is relatively small, and it is perhaps a partial response to the dislocation that's going to go on. As I say, it looks like it's going to be responsive to the inflow of technical people. So at the moment, the population dislocations that will occur from the coast and from the people who are, for example, being attracted from Venezuela, who are not technically skilled but are just attracted to the industry, that remains an unresolved problem. And the Silica City almost certainly is only a beginning of the process of the construction of alternative places for the people to live. That's not an easy thing to do when the constraint with regard to the forest is introduced. A couple of years ago, I gave a lecture in Georgetown, which I now kind of regret because I sort of made the argument that it was easy to find the relocations for the people that were affected by climate change in the interior. And now I have my doubts because of the need to both protect the forest and in addition, protect the population that lives in the forest. These are people who are called Amerindian people. So it will require quite some serious thinking about where the dislocated people from the coast and the people who are coming into the country will have to be will reside. And as you mentioned, the capital city almost certainly is going to have to be relocated. And pretty soon, as you mentioned, the projection is that they're going to be inundated by 2030. It's not easy to relocate a capital city. This is not just a question of population. It's the institutions of government that make the country function.
Right. And you know, resettling this massive population will have costs and, you know, could eat into much of the oil revenue. And so Guyana could end up breaking even as a result of all this. It depends on, you know, the numbers and there are a lot of variables involved. But this is a very costly venture. And when you move people, you have to make sure that they have employment opportunities, not just places of residence. And so you have to create an economic ecosystem out of scratch.
And then the question of the ethnic division in the country arises as well. Is one group going to be favored compared to the other group? And what kind of social tensions will result from if that is perceived in the question of people being upset in the first place because they have to move?
Right. And so that's why it points to the need for consensus-based decisions to kind of ensure that people's needs are being met and we don't have disagreement down the road and disgruntlement and successor governments overturning decisions, because to move thousands, tens of thousands of people or more is a huge decision. And to have people stuck in a state of limbo is simply in terms of where they reside is something that's going to not just upend people, but potentially anger them.
Yep.
Now, we're nearing the end of our discussion, and one other complication for Guyana is that neighboring Venezuela has renewed claims over Guyana's Essequibo region, which makes up 40% of Guyana's land area, and it's off the coast of this region where the current oil is being produced. And Venezuela had conducted a referendum in December, essentially a sham referendum, and it notionally gives the government the authority to try to quote-unquote, reclaim this area. It's also bolstered its military presence nearby. And in the short term, it looks like these threats from the Maduro regime are about posturing locally ahead of elections and maybe trying to intimidate the Guyanese government and getting some concessions from it. But, you know, down the road, there is the potential that Guyana may also have to spend more money on securing its borders, and that would take away money that could be directed at bettering its own people. Now, final question. If you were asked by the Guyanese government for advice on how to best leverage the bonanza, if they asked you to make three recommendations, what would they be?
Well, obviously, the first one is education. To be a successful participant in the global economy means that the population of Guyana will be much better educated now. Secondly, I myself would recommend that the part of, at least a substantial part, the revenue coming in be distributed in a universal way to population, something like Alaska. I do so for two reasons. One,
because the best way to eliminate or reduce poverty in the country, and secondly, because it has the potential of breaking down the political division that exists by ethnicity. And then third, I would take advantage of the experience that countries have had in trying to move an economy in the direction away from what the markets would dictate and to the creation of a diversified modern economy. And for that, what would be required is explicit creation of a highly trained center of experts with respect to investment decisions and allocation decisions, all to creating a green alternative economy. Education is central to everything. Poverty alleviation is the desired outcome. Identifying institutions and society which would move the society away from its mono development of just petroleum and to create a diversified economy. All of that is very hard to expect to occur when a country is spending as it comes in, maximizing current expenditures, and have not taken the opportunity to seriously contemplate what is the future really going to look like post-petroleum.
And that was Dr. Jay Mandel of Colgate University. Please subscribe to our show on your platform of choice, and thank you for tuning in.